This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. On the 10th of July 1917, Eamon de Valera won a by-election in East Clare, one of a series of victories for Sinn Féin in the run-up to their landslide triumph in the general election of December 1918. He would continue to represent the county in the Dáil until his election to the presidency in 1959. What was his relationship with the Banner County in the early tumultuous years of his career, during the War of Independence, the treaty negotiations, the Civil War, up to the founding of Fianna Fáil in 1926? To discuss this and related questions, I'm joined by Thomas McConmara, who's the author of The Scariff Martyrs, War, Murder and Memory in East Clare, and that's just been published by Mercer Press. Martin Manser, a former special advisor to the Irish government on Northern Ireland. Pádraig Ó Rourke, author of Truce, Murder, Myth and the Last Days of the Irish War of Independence, and that was published by Mercer in 2016. And finally, Joe Power, the author of Clare and the Civil War, published by Eastwood Books last year. And this HedgeGhoul is supported by Clare County Council and the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sports and Media under the Decade of Centenaries programme. Now, Martin Manser, to get us started, could you remind us briefly of the road travelled by de Valera over the previous few years? As I understand it, he was originally a home ruler, yet, you know, by 1917, he's president of Sinn Féin and of the Irish Volunteers.
Yeah. Born in America, brought up in neighbouring rural County Limerick, he had embarked on a teaching career in the early years of the 20th century, and he sought a mathematics chair in UCC, newly formed since 1908. And part of his credentials was that he was an orthodox home ruler. He didn't get the chair. Now, to be fair to him, he did take the view that home rule probably would not be obtained without civil war. Presumably he was talking about an all-Ireland home rule. Anyway, he joined the volunteers, sided with the minority that broke away from the Redmondite majority. But the important thing about him coming up to 1916 is that while he was an efficient military officer and so on, he didn't have any political profile. So when he was kind of next on the list for execution, General and of course Asquith was wanting the execution stopped, Maxwell asked the chief prosecutor, William Wiley, was he important? And the answer was no. He was one of two surviving commandants. It's often said he was the only surviving commandant. Thomas Ashe was the other one, but of course he died on hunger strike in 1917. And, you know, Dev was in kind of two minds as to whether when he was asked to stand for Clare. I mean, obviously there were risks for the momentum behind the movement if he didn't win, you know, the same sort of calculations that, say, Sinn Féin had to make at the time of the hunger strikes. He went for it and he won. And of course, the historic resonance of Clare going back to 1828, Daniel O'Connell and so on, and really Dev's by-election win had the same impact in catalysing, a new era.
Now, Pádraig Ó Rourke, could I bring you in on this now? Because, you know, this is a fairly dirty campaign, as I understand it.
Oh, absolutely. It was very much characterised by it was a referendum in one way on having a republic or home rule. Do you vote for the Sinn Féin or do you vote for the member of the parliamentary party? But also, as well, the Home Rule Party had an official slogan of a Clare man for Clare, and very much talked about de Valera as being a foreigner. For example, if you look at their speeches, the Home Rule Party talk about William Redmond and John Redmond and Lynch, who's the candidate, as being, quote, thoroughbred Celts, patriots and Christian Irishmen. And they denounced De Valera as, quote, a stranger, a foreigner, and a half-breed. And while their official slogan is a Clare man for Clare, the unofficial slogan, which is whitewashed on walls around the constituency, is De Valera the Jew put the bastard down. So not only is this racist and xenophobic, it's anti-Semitic, because they come up with this conspiracy theory about De Valera's parentage, which of course is, you know, a load of nonsense, but it's something that lasts over time. And during the election, there's widespread violence and rioting. And it has to be said, both sides engage in this. And there's a lot of brawling between Republicans and Home Rulers. Like, De Valera and his supporters are shot at by ambushers near Broadford on one occasion. There's several RIC baton charges. And of course, they're attacking the Sinn Féin rallies rather than Home Rule rallies. And after the election, the RIC shoot dead John Scanlon, who was an unarmed IRA volunteer joining in celebrations in Kerry. So things were really at a fever pitch. And a lot of the ugly violence against De Valera and Sinn Féin wasn't just about this conspiracy theory. It was the fact that you had Republican speakers, Protestant Republicans like Darrell Figgis visiting the constituency, making speeches for De Valera, Jewish Republican speakers like Michael Noyack. And against them are the Ancient Order of Hibernians, who are a very green Catholic nationalist organization like Green Orangemen, and the Catholic priests as well. And they're talking about how all these people are foreigners and outsiders. And I'll give you one example of this. This comes from Canon Michael Hayes, who was the parish priest of Fecal, and later, interestingly, a British spy during the War of Independence. And he says, quote, "I stand on the side of faith and fatherland for Lynch. Sinn Féin has a policy of socialism and anarchy which strikes at the very roots of Christianity. The church has warned us that Sinn Féin poses a great danger to our faith, and I urge you to rescue our religion and our country by returning Mr. Lynch a Clare man and not a foreigner like De Valera."
All right, can I just bring in Joe on that? Joe, on the position of the church, because we normally, you know, see Dev very much, very comfortably in alliance with the Catholic Church, right? So what was the situation during the by-election?
The situation, well, you know, it's rather complex. I mean, Padraig has given a fair outline of it there, but there was much more complex than that, because it must also be seen in the context that the Great War was still going on. And, you know, there were hundreds, there had been thousands of Clare volunteers. And part of much of the violence, say, in places like Ennis, was organized, I'd imagine, by people who had sons and brothers fighting over in the Great War at the time, you know. And for instance, the separation women in Ennis were pretty vociferous, and they very much were attacking the speakers. And there had to be, I mean, Michael Brennan had to bring in volunteers from East Clare to patrol the streets of Ennis to protect the supporters of De Valera and stuff like that. So it's a very complex and situation. I know, appreciate, obviously, the Ancient Order of Hibernians and the old guard were, say, in favour of the Irish party and the local man, Lynch. But, and Padraig has outlined there that, you know, some clergy like Father Hayes of Fecal. But there are other clergy that, for instance, the parish priest of Kilballyoan, Father James Clancy, he made the point that, you know, De Valera was a man who had been a felon, whereas Lynch was wearing the Crown prosecutor's clothes, basically. So who would you vote for? A man who like De Valera, who was stood for Republic, or a Crown prosecutor who was being paid by the Crown, etc. So it was simple like that. But, you know, De Valera was very impressive. I'll give you an instance. You had Colonel George O'Callaghan Westropp of Mary Fort Tulla, a well-known unionist, a Protestant. He said, when he heard De Valera speak in Tulla, "I never heard a cause pleaded with more transparent honesty and lofty patriotism. Be they right or wrong, it was Ireland first and last. Commandant De Valera is a man to be reckoned with. He stands for the purest nationality, unsullied by class hatreds, uncorrupted by appeals to greed. And while every word he utters is a cause of howling and offence to West Britons, may not the Irish hope so great a fire may light us on the road to nobler things, rather than conceive the land we hope our love in hopeless conflagration." Now, here is a man who was very much a unionist. He was greatly impressed by De Valera. But while Padraig, just go back to Padraig's point there again about the role of the clergy, most of the junior clergy were absolutely in favor of De Valera. Dozens of them. We're in Ennis when De Valera had his major speech in Ennis around in June, 10th of June, from that time onwards. And they were clearly prominent. While some of the old guard, some of the canons and stuff like that were against De Valera, the younger men were not. And another point, I just look and say, from a local level in the Enniskillen Castle area, while the Irish Party was clearly in favour of Lynch, and because he had local connections, but the Trade and Labour Association were also in favour of Lynch, the kind of a socialist party in Clare at the time, you might say. And then, of course, De Valera was attacked. And I believe, Pádraic has said there were bullets were fired. I believe the contents of a chamber pot were emptied on De Valera in Clare Castle as he passed through or thrown at the car. The point is, they weren't all in favour. So in places like Clare Castle, they weren't all in favour of Lynch, because quite simply, in August of 1917, after the election, the local, the GA club, organised a Sinn Féin election fund, a sports day. This is amazing. Here is a GA club organising in Clare Castle. Clare Castle wasn't all Redmondite. There were strong, and over, bear in mind, in the rural areas of the parish, you had out in Dara, that's where the Barretts of that region, they were leading Republicans. And down in the rural parts of the parish of Clare Castle Ballier, the Sinn Féiners were strongest. But even in the village itself, there were clearly some Sinn Féin supporters. So quite simply, it was a very rather complex situation. And but there's no doubt about it. It was a huge emotional event. And for instance, Edward MacLeod of Raheen, he was a member of the Irish Convention in 1917 and later a senator. And he said, most people under the age of 60, now this is recorded later, he said, most people under the age of 60 find it hard to realize the spirit at once enthusiastic and indomitable, which then permeated our entire population. And many of those who shared that exhilarating experience cannot know or capture it. And I think that really captures the huge emotional and psychological impact of De Valera's victory in Clare in 1917. It was clearly a victory for the men of 1916, the spirit of 1916. De Valera stood for that, and the people of Clare backed him up on that one, by huge numbers, 5,000 to 2,000 or something like that. 69% of the vote De Valera got at that time, as against 28.6 for
so it was decisive.
Absolutely.
Very decisive vote. Could I bring Tomás in there? Because Martin mentioned a hunger strike. Now, what's that in reference to, Tomás?
Sure, Tommy. Yeah. The hunger strike relates, of course, to the Maunchai hunger strike of September 1917. But there's a direct correlation between what happens in Clare and what Pádraic and Joe have outlined, and what happens over the following months. But just before, if I can make one small point in relation to the election, I think maybe, it's slightly problematic to present it as a De Valera victory, or that people were supportive of De Valera. Of course, people like O'Callaghan Westropp were impressed by De Valera, but I think it's fair to say that the support that was there was for this broad Sinn Féin idea, this broad idea of separatism, which was only sort of beginning to cohere at that time. I think De Valera's role in it is probably overstated because of what he subsequently did. In the election itself, I think it was more of an energy that was behind the Sinn Féin movement. The fact that you had for the first time publicly this momentum, this public demonstration of republicanism, women are involved, at a public level, even though they can't vote. And you have younger people politically mobilizing like you never had before. So I think De Valera's role is not really as important at that time, but it becomes quite important. And I think by the time we get through the hunger strike, which I'll reflect on now, and we get to the end of 1917, De Valera has then ascended to a place of political and military significance. But what's important to note is after the East Clare election, the volunteers in Clare recognised the value of, public demonstrations of republicanism. And they recognised the problem in having a vacuum, because since the 1916 Rising, really there hadn't been much publicly happening. Obviously, so many of them were in jail in Frongoch and England, etc. But then we saw in Roscommon a sense of what a public demonstration could do. We saw in Longford the same thing in May. But then in July, we saw in Clare more powerfully than anywhere else. Even the violence that Pádraic referred to, which was quite dramatic and very serious, there had been an actual, benefit to that in terms of the Republican movement demonstrating the support they had, demonstrating the way in which they, what they would have characterized as, you know, the British establishment, even though represented by the Irish Party, was coming down on them. So the volunteers were very keen after that to maintain that sense of momentum, and they implemented a three-phased policy without approval of GHQ to openly drill in front of the police, which was prohibited by the Defence of the Realms regulation, to refuse to recognise the court when they were arrested, and then finally, most importantly, to demand political prisoner status, and when that was denied, inevitably as it would be, to go on hunger strike. And that ended up in a summer of, I suppose, hostility, arrest, demonstrations, organised often by coming on when a volunteer in Clare would be arrested, there would be a demonstration at the train station, etc. So it was a very public confrontation between Republicans and British rule, which ended up in approximately 39 prisoners in Mountjoy Jail at the start of September, 16 of them from County Clare. And within Mountjoy, it's very evident that the Clare Republicans were intent on continuing the offensive against British authority, now represented by the jail authorities. And with the support of men like Tomás Ash that Martin mentioned earlier on, Sean Tracy and others, political status was demanded. It was, of course, denied. And on the 20th of September, a hunger strike began with 38 prisoners. Richard Coleman, Dick Coleman, decided not to go on the hunger strike. But what was really significant, of course, is that the British immediately introduced force feeding on the prisoners. And that resulted in 5 days into the hunger strike on the 25th of September, Tomás Ash dying as a result of force feeding. And it is my contention that that death and the funeral that followed are as significant in my view, and perhaps more significant than the 1916 Rising in terms of its effect on political consciousness, because the Irish people are far more attuned to separatism now. They're far more confident about the idea of expressing it. And now a young man has died as a result of what was seen as a very barbaric form of force feeding. So that left the Republican movement in a far more consolidated position moving into October. And we must recognise, of course, that in October, De Valera is elected as both the president of Sinn Féin and the president of the Irish Volunteers. So now within the space of a few months, a relatively unknown figure, you know, has been propelled into political life and has now ascended to the top, both politically and militarily, in the Irish Volunteer movement. And that movement he's now at the top of is very much consolidated in the consciousness of the Irish people, particularly as a result of the hunger strike and the death of Ash. And the role of 16 Claremen in that is really critical.
Yeah, so, I mean, the point is like the death of Ash left Dev as the undisputed leader, and he's now president of both Sinn Féin and the Irish Volunteers. So the whole thing, I mean, obviously he wasn't responsible for the death of Tomás Ash, right? But it left him as the undisputed leader. Joe, can I just come back to you, like, just on the Clare connection again? I think what Tomás has outlined there is that the election of Dev isn't a flash in the pan. There's lots of stuff still going on the ground in Clare. But did Dev consolidate his links with the county, you know, in the late summer, going into the autumn of 1917?
Yes, that is true. He came back in the end of around September, the end of September, September the 29th until Saturday the 6th of October. And he stayed a week touring around Clare. And he consolidated his links very much. His base was originally in the Old Ground Hotel. And from there, he made a triumphal tour, not just in East Clare, but he went to all over Clare, and in every big town and small town and villages he spoke, and he was enthusiastically received. He was there in the uniform of the volunteers, and he was for instance, something like 20,000-25,000 people went to hear him at Ennis. But everywhere he went, he was mobbed, surrounded by volunteers, by Sinn Féin people, by women, by everybody. He was really, really popular. But everywhere he went as well, and almost in every place, the meetings which were held and organized by Sinn Féin and by the volunteers, the Catholic clergy, especially the junior clergy, but very often the senior, the parish priests, were chairing the meetings that were being held all over the county. And at the meeting in Ennis, Bishop Fogarty, for the first time, publicly came out in support of De Valera and of the Sinn Féin policies. He'd been privately supportive of that before that point in letters to his friend, Bishop of Limerick. But after this election, he finally came out publicly in support of De Valera. Now, we know that Bishop Fogarty had been very much prominent in the denunciation of the treatment of the hunger strikers and especially of the death of Thomas Ashe. But as Padraig referred to there, and the importance of that, the funeral, that Ashe's death, and in reigniting, say, the Irish nationalism, etc. But on the day of Thomas Ashe's funeral, De Valera was in Ennis. And this, I find it extraordinary that they found it, that he did not go to Dublin to attend that funeral, which was attended by perhaps 100,000 people. Dev was in Clare. And why was that? Well, obviously, he and the party in Clare had organized this tour. And I suppose he didn't want to disappoint them, but he also wanted to ensure perhaps his own popularity. Now, while he was in Ennis, he did refer to the tragedy and the deaths taking place and the funeral on that day. But on the day of, as I said, of Ashe's funeral, there he was. De Valera was in Clare, consolidating his victory. And secondly, another point is that, as I referred to it earlier, the Catholic Church was powerful. You know, everywhere he went, the clergy were there. There was huge meetings. And now, for instance, it's almost remarkable. He was almost giving succor to the idea that home rule would be Rome rule. At Ogonillo, at a meeting chaired by Father O'Mara, a parish priest, De Valera said, "The enemies of Ireland knew that the priests of Ireland were arrayed against them. They knew that with the priests leading the way and with the parishioners falling in with them, they had no power to beat them." And I said to myself, my goodness, that sounds almost like home rule would be Rome rule. And De Valera was very much aligning himself that time with the clergy, and they were leading. And De Valera, the junior clergy, and of course, once Bishop Fogarty became converted, then most of the rest of the clergy in the county were very much in favour of Sinn Féin and in favour of following De Valera's policies. But I think the only place where a priest was not allowed on the platform was out in Kilrush, and where I think Dean McInerney was very much anti-De Valera, anti-Sinn Féin. And he actually forbade the parish, the curate from speaking, Father Maloney. Well, he said by some ecclesiastical jurisdiction or rules, he could not attend the meeting. But he did send a letter to the meeting, but he couldn't personally attend the meeting, because his superior had banned him from doing so. But in every other parish, in every other town in the county, the clergy were very much behind De Valera. And I think that is probably understated. I think that De Valera was very much in tune with the Catholic Church at that time, certainly in Clare in a way, and whatever other counties. But that was the way it was, as far as I could see. So his victory.
Joe, can I just bring Martin in here now? Because like this is part of the Sinn Féin have a fair win behind them. They win the series of by-elections. And then, of course, Martin, they win this sensational general election victory in 1918. So, Martin, just getting back to De Valera, right? I mean, do you think De Valera has been given the credit for these organizational successes and the anti-conscription campaign?
Both himself and Thomas Ashe, they had enormous prestige as being the only surviving commandants of 1916. But he Arthur Griffith gave way to him in October 1917. So he was both the political and military head of a united movement. And then, of course, the conscription crisis came up and he played a leading role in that. Furthermore, he was somebody, perhaps because of his American background, he had quite a good geopolitical understanding. And he and in Ashe, while he was alive, immediately saw the significance of, President Wilson's rhetoric about the war aims being the rights of small nations and people not being ruled against their will and so on. And what we call national self-determination. And this provided a very credible framework for the Irish independence movement to put in, and Dev played a leading role in expounding that. And then, of course, the stunning general election victory. If you're a leader through all that period. And essentially he united, this only happened three times really in Irish history. I mean, the New Departure, 1878, bringing together different elements, what happened in 1917, 1918, and then I would argue what happened in the early stages of the peace process, bringing together, virtually all of nationalist Ireland. I mean, each of these were preludes to very big political breaks. So yes, I think that he does deserve a lot of credit for winning. A string of stunning political victories. I mean, remember, I mean, the Home Rule Party had been totally dominant only 4 years beforehand in 1914, and he virtually completely displaced it, outside of Ulster.
Yeah, just Martin, just before you finish up, I mean, he's jailed, of course, for his part in the so-called German plot, and then he's famously sprung from Lincoln Jail. Now, I have to say, as a result of the Neil Jordan film, I forever have this image of Dev in high heels and a fur coat. So, Martin, could you just set the record straight on that particular escape?
Yeah, well... as Terry De Valera wrote in his memoir, and I quote it, along the escape route, this from Lincoln Jail, Boland was wearing a fur-lined coat and pretended to be my father's girl. Now, if you think about it for even a moment, I mean, De Valera was tall, Boland was much shorter, and so, I mean, it is much more plausible given the difference in height. But even Tim Pat Coogan in his book in Michael Collins, he actually... says the same thing. He said, so the prisoners were freed, completing their escape by Boland wrapping his fur coat around the gangling De Valera, putting his arm around him as though they were a courting couple. I think it was changed. Kim Pat Coogan, biographer of De Valera, was the historical advisor to the Michael Collins film, and of course he's often liked to call De Valera sort of cute whore, so it kind of fitted in with that. So you'd call it artistic license, and the Michael Collins film was certainly a very successful cultural coup, putting Michael Collins center stage and displacing De Valera, whereas I think I would sort of tend to balance the two more than that.
Now, so De Valera is released anyway, and then he, in June 1919, he heads off to America now, and I'll come back to that in a second, right? But Tomás, maybe could you maybe come in on this? Who minds the shop in Clare while Dev is away? I mean, is this a blank in the narrative of this particular discussion, or how is Dev's absence? What's its significance in Clare on the ground?
I don't think it's that significant at all, to be honest, Tommy. At that point in the evolution of the struggle, because Dev's role becomes more and more, I suppose, about the broader, national politic and the strategy behind that. You have seen Sinn Féin as a political party have become far more coherent. Even by the end of 1917, they've developed policies, and that took time because obviously it had to shift, ideologically from the Sinn Féin it had been prior to 1916, and that was fairly much consolidated by the end of 1917, certainly into 1918. So by the time De Valera heads to America in 1919, the political, I suppose, had shifted to a degree to the military, and you had seen the brigades established. You had seen, who was going to be the key leadership within the military struggle in Clare had been well established by 1918. So the Brennans in East Clare, the Barretts that Joe mentioned earlier on in Mid Clare, the O'Donnells, etc., in West Clare. So in terms of the shift in the dynamic of the struggle to a more military conflict on the ground, what was well established at that stage. So once those kind of dynamic, once that dynamic was established, there wasn't really much contribution De Valera was going to be able to make. His contribution was at a much broader level in terms of the national situation. So
you know, I don't think it's any more relevant to Clare than it is to Ireland, his absence. I think it's obviously very significant from the national leadership of the Republican movement that De Valera is in America. It's significant in terms of what he's trying to achieve out there. It's significant in terms of what he does out there. You know, the suggestion that he is at least partly responsible for splitting the Irish support, Irish-American support out there. And that's probably for another day's debate. But I don't think, Tommy, in answer to your question, that there's that dramatic significance to Clare at a ground level. You know, Sinn Féin had become well-established militarily, as I say, and even politically then they'd already begin to win rural, well, urban district council easily, rural district councils less so, but certainly were well-established, a well-established movement at that stage. So I don't think it had that much significance at a local level.
Now, I just remind listeners that we had a head school last year on Dev's trip to America, but I'm not just going to refer everyone to that, because Martin Mansour, can I just bring you in very quickly, right? How would you assess the success or otherwise of Dev's time in the United States?
More successful than historians are inclined to credit nowadays. I mean, first of all, he was there to, you know, raise the national loan. But far more important, I mean, he was there. It was the best platform to put the Irish case internationally, and of course had to contend with British propaganda about, you know, Sinn Féin being the movement that was the allies of the defeated Imperial Germany. The other thing is, of course, is that America was Britain's Achilles heel, because they were hugely indebted after the First World War to America. And if they were to get any relief on the debt, which they needed, they needed the support of Congress. And, you know, they weren't going to get the support of Congress while the Black and Tans and others were sort of rampaging over Ireland.
Some parallels with our present situation, Brexit there, Mark, but maybe we shouldn't go there for the moment. Can I just bring Joe in here? Joe, Dev is back in Ireland then in December 1920 right now. War of Independence still has another 6 months or so to run up until the truce. Did Dev spend any time in Clare, you know, from December 1920 up to the truce?
Not to my knowledge.
Not
to my knowledge, but I think it's significant that he returned in December 20, because in December 20 there was a huge major effort made by say, what's his name, Lloyd George and the British to have a truce, and you had Archbishop Clune of Perth, a Clare-born person, was involved in major peace negotiations in December 1920. And they obviously failed, but because the British insisted on the IRA demilitarizing, demobilizing their weapons, whatever, before a truce. But there were definitely peace feelers around that time, and there might have been peace, might have been achieved in 1920. Who knows? But the point is that Bishop Fogarty and Archbishop Clune were very much involved in truce negotiations with the leaders of the IRA and Sinn Féin in Ireland at the time. After Griffith, Michael Collins, they consulted them, and then the Archbishop Clune went back to America, back to London again to meet Lloyd George several times. But anyway, it came to nothing. But I think it might have been significant De Valera returned then. He might have heard about those negotiations and maybe brought him back. I don't know. It's a factor, I think. It might have helped him. But to my knowledge, he didn't stay in Clare, or took no. He wasn't certainly, to my knowledge, in Clare up to the troops. Yes.
Joe, he was there twice though during the treaty negotiations, right?
Now, yes, but not
significance of that.
Yes, but in around the time that the treaty was signed, it's amazing. Again, I'm amazed at this one. But he spent I think the treaty was signed on the 5th of December. On the 29th of November, I think, De Valera came to Clare, and he spent about 3 days touring around County Clare, speaking to the soldiers and the volunteers, inspecting their parades, etc., and making a few speeches, and kept saying that the negotiations, for instance, on the 1st of December, he said, talking about the negotiations going on at the time, he said, the time is not exactly one for talking. We have a national representatives at a peace conference. When they report their work, we can discuss it. We have given them work to do, and we have full confidence that they will do it. It is not for us here at this moment to discuss their work. It's not right when we give a delegation work to do that we should cut in on their work and talk business that is really their business. Now, that's extraordinary.
That's a contradiction of his own position that he took subsequently.
Clearly, but this is what he said. This is a speech in the town hall on the 1st of December before a huge audience there.
And, could I bring Padraig in on this, right? Padraig, yeah. You wanted to come in on this, and I'll bring it back in a minute, Joe.
In terms of when the day the treaty was signed and the news of it breaking, according to Ernie O'Malley, De Valera was actually in County Clare at the time. The 1st Western Division, which was a newly created unit of the IRA, comprising the three Clare Brigades, the West Clare Brigade, the Mid Clare Brigade, East Clare Brigade, but also an area of South Galway, they had a massive parade near the town of Six Mile Bridge at a place called Glenwood. Now, this had been picked as the site because it had been the scene of a very successful IRA ambush in January of 1921, during which six RIC constables were killed. And if you Google online, you can actually see De Valera and Cathal Brua standing on the platform as Michael Brennan, Patrick Brennan and the other volunteers march past. And it's a huge military occasion with thousands of, hundreds of IRA volunteers marching. And even the IRA have built and are attempting to fire their own artillery gun. The newly arrived Thompson machine guns from the United States, a few of them are actually visible and on display in the photos, and British Pathe or Pathé are there, and they're actually filming this parade. And that's where De Valera is when news that the treaty has agreed has been signed. That's just what I wanted to add.
Right. And just going back to Joe.
Just to
share with you, like we had a head school on the treaty, which it's just been posted on our website. But one of the points made in that discussion is that the discussion about the treaty, in many respects, was an elite discussion by people at the top, right? And one of the points made was there was very little attempt made to prepare the grassroots for the possibility of compromise.
Yes.
Now, Joe, what do you make of that? Because it seems to me that Dev is making some attempt to talk to the people in Clare, right? But is he preparing them? Does he prepare them for the compromises?
Well, I said after the Glenwood, as Padraig outlined there, he went back to Dublin to meet the plenipotentiaries who had returned from London for the last time before the treaty was signed, and there they had obviously major discussions. But he returned to Clare again on the 4th of December. And on Sunday, he was at concerts in Ennis, and he met with the Bishop of State, Bishop Dr. Fogarty Westburn. He was a frequent guest of Bishop Fogarty at this time, before the treaty was signed. And then he said, it's extraordinary. He talked about the treaty. Then he says, I will not deal with the political situation because it is a time during which I cannot deal with it as freely as I would wish. And then he talked about cultural nationalism. And then he made this extraordinary speech that if he had to choose between Irish freedom and the Irish language, he would choose the Irish language, even if it meant loss of Irish freedom. And then he said, this is why the cause of Irish freedom is bound to triumph in the end, whether today or tomorrow. And was he at that point preparing his audience for the fact that they mightn't get what they wanted in the treaty, that he knew they weren't going to get a republic? But he was obviously, he'd been talking up their principles, and this is what they were looking for all the time. But I think at this point, he began to try and prepare his audience or the people that were listening to him for the fact that maybe they may not get an Irish Republic as what they were looking for, and what he was been telling the people, that's what they were there for. And that's why I find it extraordinary that he was talking about preferring Irish language, an Irish speaking society rather than a free Irish society, if you had to choose.
Okay, can I bring Tomás in that? He wants to come in on that. Tomás?
Yeah, thanks, Tommy. I just wanted to kind of make the point, you know, Joe's use of De Valera's words is very important there, because I think De Valera rarely said anything without serious consideration behind it. He was very calculated in the use of words.
throughout his political career. So I think there definitely was some point he was trying to make with regard to the comments that Joe has quoted there. But I think it's important to say that by December 1920, I would say by October, even before the negotiations began officially, De Valera was patently aware that an Irish Republic, as had been presented in, you know, innumerable speeches, you know, and in the kind of the public statements made by Sinn Féin, was not possible. You know, that there was no way that Lloyd George was going to break on the idea of a full independent Irish Republic. So I think, you know, we could obviously debate the treaty and, you know, who had the right to sign, etc. But I think there's no doubt in my mind that De Valera understood fully when he was standing in Clare at that stage that a republic, as I said, as outlined, was possible. So perhaps he was trying to make some subtle comments that would prepare people, but, you know, I suppose given what he said subsequently during the Civil War and during the debates, maybe those comments shouldn't have been so subtle. But I think he certainly knew at that stage.
Maybe can I bring Martin in this? Martin, so I just move things on to the treaty vote. I mean, did Dev miscalculate on that and on his subsequent failure to get elected president of Dáil Éireann? Because he resigned, stood for election, and he only missed out by 2 votes, right? But he still lost, right? So then he's out in the cold, essentially.
Yes, I do want to make the point that, I mean, from even before the truce, I mean, Dev was perceived as a moderate. You know, and sort of Michael Collins, the opposite. Obviously, those positions gradually changed. But I think people should never underestimate with political leaders of whatever stripe is, they have to tack this way and that way. I mean, you will not find a perfect straight line consistency in statements. It depends on what audience they're talking for, you know, what their expectations are. Yes, well, and of course, in relation to already by October, he was pushing as a compromise the external association idea, which was meant to, if you like, bridge the gap between Dominion status and sort of Commonwealth membership and the so-called isolated republic. Yes, I mean, I think clearly he miscalculated on in a number of ways. His idea that he would be able to come in at the end of the sort of treaty negotiations and maybe solve some impasse, that was a miscalculation. He clearly miscalculated that he had a majority in cabinet when the delegates came back, and he, as you said, narrowly lost out in terms of the treaty debate, and maybe the idea that somehow the vote on the treaty could be separated from the vote on the presidency, that was a miscalculation. A further miscalculation made going forward is that people like himself and Cathal Brewer, they completely overestimated their ability to control the military side of the movement. I mean, the military side of the movement declared their independence within a couple of months of the political movement. And by the time you get to the Civil War, the leader of the Republican movement is Liam Lynch. It's not Éamon de Valera.
Well, Pádraig, can I bring Pádraig in on that, Pádraig? I mean, wasn't Dev, wasn't he caught between two fires here? I'm talking about the spring of 1922, right? I mean, he's outmaneuvered by Collins and the pro-treaty side on one hand, but he's distrusted by the anti-treaty IRA on the other.
Absolutely, Tommy. But before I get into that, one thing that I think is very interesting about the treaty debates is the kind of slander or the abuse De Valera got for so-called being a foreigner actually comes up again at the end of the treaty debates when De Valera and company, the anti-treaty Republicans, walk out. Michael Collins stands up and shouts at them, "Traitors, deserters, foreigners, Americans, English." And that is aimed at the likes of Erskine Childers, Constance Markovitch, and De Valera, of course, is the foreigner and the American. And I just think it's fascinating that somebody who, even though he was born in America, grew up in Ireland, fought in 1916, spoke the Irish language fluently, got abused throughout his life for being a so-called foreigner. And it's the kind of thing that the blue shirts threw at him later. But going back to your point, was he outmaneuvered by the pro-treaty side and distrusted or dismissed by the anti-treaty? Absolutely. You had divisions on both sides. You had people in the pro-treaty camp like Cosgrave, Griffith and O'Higgins, who accepted the treaty as a fait accompli. And then you have people like Richard Mulcahy and Michael Collins, who saw it as a stepping stone to the Republic. And they really were trying to overthrow the North, giving guns to the Northern IRA and dismantle the treaty secretly. So you had divisions between kind of moderates and militant hardliners on the pro-treaty side. And that happens to De Valera as well on the anti-treaty side. De Valera and Cathal Brua were willing to accept document number two as a compromise. But then you had people who saw themselves very much as soldiers, more so than politicians, people like Liam Mellows, Liam Lynch, Rory O'Connor, who wanted nothing less than a complete republic. And to them, at this stage, by the time the Civil War is happening, De Valera doesn't matter. I mean, Liam Lynch famously had declared that we have sworn for a republic, we will live by no other law. Rory O'Connor, who's really leading the most militant IRA faction, because even the opponents of the treaty are factionalized at this stage, says that, quote, "I'm no more prepared to stand for De Valera than for the treaty." So the political opposition to the treaty was made redundant by the military men. And is he outmaneuvered by Collins? Well, you have the De Valera-Collins Pact, and this promises, you know, to change the Free State Constitution and make it just Republican enough to keep De Valera and his supporters, those that believe in document number two, on board. And, you know, there is an attempt, in fairness to Collins, to do that. He tries to fiddle with the oath or remove it. And there's a very interesting quote or piece of information from Michael D. Higgins in the foreword he wrote to the History Ireland special on the Civil War, that Collins had tried to include a quote from the 1916 proclamation in the draft Free State Constitution, but it was, inverted commas, too Bolshevik for the British government, so it had to be left out. And eventually, when this Free State Constitution is published on the 16th of June, 1922, it's just 2 days before the election, and it really is the same constitution that had been presented before. So De Valera had been hoping for a big gain for his anti-treaty people, that he could bring them on board in a compromise, and that never happens. And when the Civil War actually begins itself, De Valera has little or no control over the IRA. He's totally outmaneuvered and overshadowed by the militants like Rory O'Connor and Liam Lynch. And when the shooting starts, De Valera has no command. He enlists as an ordinary IRA volunteer and is fighting in O'Connell Street in Dublin. And then he goes into hiding. And people used to refer to De Valera as the chief. But during the Civil War, Liam Lynch was referred to as, quote, the real chief. And really, for most of the Civil War, De Valera is, you know, he's redundant to the military situation. And it's not until late in the conflict that the anti-treatyites get the idea of setting up an alternative state and a republican government. But by then, you know, again, nobody is paying any attention to it. And De Valera's arrest in August of 1923, months after the Civil War had ended, that effectively relaunches his political career, re-establishes him as this Republican hardliner, because if he hadn't been arrested, if the war had just gone straight ahead, he would have been, you know, irrelevant afterwards as well.
Can I bring Tomás in on that? You know, Dev, I mean, we've established then that Dev was a marginal figure during the War of Independence. Did he spend any time in Clare, Tomás?
Civil War now, Tommy?
Yeah, the Civil War period.
He did towards the end of it, obviously leading up to his arrest in 1923. And again, there would be numerous stories about De Valera staying in people's homes, and he must have slept under the bed of many, many people from the different stories I encountered. But obviously some of those were true, you know, because he would have been sheltered, particularly back around West Clare, in Tully Crane, for example, you know. But that was leading up, in my understanding, up until August 1923. Prior to that, I don't think he was in the county much from, you know, mid-22 leading into mid-23.
How credible, sorry, Tomás, just to cut across you, how credible are those stories then? I mean, do you reckon they are, you know, facts after the
you know, no, I mean, you see, I
claims after the fact, rather.
No, I think you see, Tommy, and I've obviously looked very closely at memory, and there's, of course, huge potential for falsehoods in there. I also think that De Valera's sort of mystique and popularity grows over time. So I think when we're reflecting on De Valera in Clare, we can't separate it out from the De Valera of the 30s and 40s and how his kind of popularity grew for people during that time. So in memory then, to have an association with De Valera, have been in your home, would be very, very important. So there's no doubt there might be some embellishment with some people, but certainly wherever he did go and whenever he did stay in particular houses, and he used to go to specific homes, obviously for obvious reasons that he could trust and he had the support around it to protect him. So that would become really important for people, and those memories would endure to have that connection with De Valera. But just to make the broader point, I think like he is marginalized during the Civil War because, you know, some very obvious realities become apparent. And one of those obvious realities is that De Valera really didn't ever have any control or influence over the IRA during the War of Independence, you know, largely because he was in America for so long. But even when he returned, you know, he had no real key understanding of the dynamic at a local level in terms of the guerrilla struggle. Whereas it was perceived, of course, that Michael Collins had more of an understanding as others in the leadership who were around had. So I don't think he ever really had a strong footing with regard to the IRA, you know, because there was, you know, while there's of course an incredibly strong connection, but there is also a separation between what is Sinn Féin and what is the IRA. You know, back to 1917, when all those men on hunger strike from Clare wrote their names in autograph books that I saw, they described themselves as members of the IRA in Clare. There was no reference to Sinn Féin. Many of them dismissed the involvement of Sinn Féin as just a side issue. So I do think sometimes we overestimate De Valera's influence on the IRA even prior to the Civil War. But as Padraig said, he got an opportunity to kind of reinvigorate himself or reinvent himself subsequent to that, which brought him back into the public imagination.
Well, Tomasa, I mean, I hear what you're saying about his lack of influence in the IRA, but from a political point of view, I mean, it's quite astute to kind of engineer his arrest in Ennis in August 1923, in order to reconnect with his constituents to some extent and make a national kind of a public statement.
Yeah, I mean, no one should ever underestimate the intelligence of De Valera or how strategic he was. So like I said about his words, you know, his actions were very calculated as well. So, you know, it was an incredibly tense time in the middle or in August 1923. So when De Valera stood up in at the O'Connell Monument at the height in Ennis, you know, he knew fully what the consequence was going to be. So, you know, he was very, very aware of that dynamic politically. And, you know, I wouldn't take away the political significance he had, you know, throughout that time. But I just think there's a necessary separation at times when we're analysing between the fighting men on the ground and the kind of higher politics. That's not to suggest that the fighting men didn't have an understanding of the politics, but in terms of the influence, in terms of the loyalty at that time, I think it's useful to separate it to some extent.
Now, Padraig, I want to look at the you know, the period after 1923 up to the founding of Fianna Fáil in 1926. What's happening in Clare in this period, right? And did it have any bearing on Dev's subsequent policies?
Yeah, there's quite a lot happening in Clare, and it has an effect in that De Valera is trying to reconnect and still needs the support of the Republican base. In the Civil War, you had five IRA volunteers from the Republican side executed by the Free State. One of them was the chairman of the Clare County Board, GA, and that caused quite a lot of bitterness. Generally, East Clare had been pro-treaty and Mid and West Clare IRA had been anti-treaty. And a lot of the Republicans, when they were released from prison in 1923, simply had to emigrate because they couldn't get jobs in the new Free State, because in the civil service, as a teacher, as a doctor, you had to swear an oath of loyalty to the Free State and the Commonwealth and so on. De Valera at this time is locked up himself. He's the last prisoner released from Kilmainham Jail in July of 1924. And Sinn Féin, who of course are his party, are doing quite badly in the 1925 election. And De Valera starts talking in 1925, 1926 about dropping abstentionism. He's forming the idea of getting Fianna Fáil together, but he can't leave the IRA base behind. There's still about 20,000 to 25,000 active IRA volunteers nationwide, and there's a strong hardcore of them in West Clare. And again, he needs their support. And what's happening on the ground in Clare, there's occasional attacks on the Gardaí. There's raids on Garda barracks by the IRA in Clare, usually where they steal documents and Garda uniforms. And really, it's a war between the Gardaí and the kind of IRA diehards in Clare rather than the IRA and the Free State Army at this stage. And the kind of things that happened in 1929, Patrick Murray, who was an IRA volunteer in West Clare, was turned by the Gardaí into an informer, and he sold the location of an IRA arms dump. Now, Murray was disappeared by the IRA. His body has never been recovered. And a month or two later, in 1929, in June, I think, you have the Tully Crine box bombing, when the IRA lure Detective Garda Tygo O'Sullivan to a supposed IRA arms dump, but they booby-trapped it with a bomb and it explodes, killing O'Sullivan. Now, both of these were the work of the IRA's West Clare Brigade leader, T.J. Ryan. And Gardaí took revenge by abducting Ryan, assaulting him, and basically beating him to a pulp. Now, when De Valera forms Fianna Fáil, enters the Dáil as a opposition, he asked questions of the Minister of Justice about what had happened to Ryan and the activity of the Gardaí and the special branch in particular in Clare. And the Minister of Justice responds by telling De Valera that the guards had no involvement and that TJ Ryan had been, quote, kicked by one of his cows. But the fact that De Valera is standing up representing an IRA hardliner in, you know, Parliament shows that he still needs their support. He's not pushing himself away from them yet. And Sinn Féin, the people who didn't follow De Valera in the late 20s, early 30s, had very little support. Fianna Fáil was where it was at. Many IRA were supportive of De Valera and canvassed for Fianna Fáil, which was, remember, a slightly constitutional party. And how De Valera, you know, tried to keep this base with him, when he got into power in the early 1930s, he, of course, released IRA prisoners. He abolished for a period the military courts, the special tribunals, and this was very popular with the Republican base. He removed Owen O'Duffy as Garda Commissioner. And later you have the land wars, or land annuities, and the economic war. And again, all very popular. And in 1934, De Valera issues a call for, quote, a fusion of all Republican forces. And essentially he's calling in the IRA to join Fianna Fáil. And the IRA reject this. They issue a statement saying that it was a sentimental and meaningless plea for unity when the ultimate aim upon which the Fianna Fáil party was founded, the restoration of the Republic of Ireland, seems to have been lost. So it's in 1934, 1935, finally, when you've the IRA involved in the Dublin transport strike, you've the IRA fighting with blue shirts in the streets of Ennis and elsewhere, and sometimes that results in killings, like IRA volunteer John Glynn. They've become a problematic organisation. De Valera has invited them to join Fianna Fáil. They haven't taken up the offer. So in 1934, 1935 in particular, De Valera reintroduces these powers, starts his government starts prosecuting people for IRA activity. And that's when finally he leaves militant republicanism behind him and goes fully constitutional.
Now, I just want to wrap up here, maybe go to you, Joe, right? Because again, you know, I'm looking at the you know, the loyalty that it was for De Valera and Clare. It is remarkable. I mean, Dev's very much a Marmite figure. Either you love him or you hate him. Joe, throughout all of this, right, I'm talking about, right, I mean, presumably De Valera was standing for election after election, initially for Sinn Féin and then eventually for Fianna Fáil, and he's getting elected each time, is he?
Absolutely. De Valera tops the poll every time he stood for election in Clare from 1917 up until 1966. He was by far the most outstanding and most successful candidate ever in Clare. And the people of Clare, his supporters, never abandoned him. Now, at times, the percentages might oscillate between, say, he got 69% in 1917, but his very last presidential election, 1966, he got 64%.
That's huge in what was a very tight contest. I mean, that's
very huge at that time, yeah, against,
yeah,
Tom
2-1.
Higgins.
Yeah.
But even against McKeown back in 1959, he got 65%. So he was consistent there. But even after he left Fianna Fáil founded Fianna Fáil in 26, left Sinn Féin, most of the supporters in Sinn Féin at the time, followers of Dev, followed De Valera into Fianna Fáil. And for instance, in the election of 1927, De Valera got 33.8% of the vote, more than 13,000. O'Higgins of Sinn Féin, Brian O'Higgins, got 1,400 votes, about 3% of the vote, 3.6% of the total valid poll. So, and he did not get elected and didn't stand in subsequent elections. So broadly speaking, De Valera brought the people, brought the Sinn Féin supporters, his Sinn Féin supporters, into Fianna Fáil, consolidated democracy there. They followed him pragmatically into a democratic route rather than staying outside the Dáil and being obviously impotent outside of the Dáil. And he entered the Dáil. He admitted that it was painful and humiliating and embarrassing for him, both himself and his supporters, when he actually went into the Dáil, signed the book, etc., even though denying he was taking an oath. But at the same time, his main supporters in Clare did not abandon him. And time again, they voted for him. And even in the two elections in 1927, he got 33%, 34%. 1932, he was up at 30%. In a year after, or 9 months or so after being a Taoiseach, in a snap election in 33, he got 18,000 votes. He was 6,000 more than he was in 1932. It was 42% of the local total valid poll there at that time. His lowest percentage constitutional vote in Clare was in the 1937, when he only got 28.5%. That was the lowest percentage ever he got, which is ironic in view of the fact he was bringing in a new constitution. His vote went up again in the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1938, and during the emergency, it stayed over 30%. And right up again, would you believe it? His very last election in Clare, general election, was 1957, and he got 16,159 votes, 44.7% of the electorate of Clare. That's extraordinary. This is 40 years after his first election. This guy, Eamon de Valera, is still the chief. He still has that magic touch. He has huge support in County Clare. And they idolized him. They certainly did. But interestingly, back in 1923, when he got 40-something percent, that was the very first election since 1919 that was actually contested in Clare. There wasn't any election in 1918, wasn't contested. No election in 21 or 22. There was no election then because there were no other candidates, only the minimum candidates. And but interestingly, the very first one, 1923, De Valera got 17,762 votes. And interesting, that was the first time women voted in Clare, even though they had votes since 1918. It was the first time they got an opportunity to vote at a general election in Clare. And there was obviously huge support for De Valera from the women of Clare, because coming them on clearly were, broadly speaking, in support of De Valera and Sinn Féin at that time. That's amazing. But as I said, he was consistently supported by his... Obviously, there were opponents of De Valera didn't like him, but he seemed to get more who liked him than disliked him. And he was outstandingly successful. There's no doubt about that. Right through Clare, he topped the poll every time, had sometimes more than two quotas, and most times at least 1.5 quotas. So huge success for De Valera. And the Banner County remained loyal to him right to the very end. And so that's all I can say. It was amazing. You know, it was just...
Okay, Joe, I think I'm going to leave it there, because you've explained that the De Valera, you know, Clare phenomenon pretty well. Listen, I'm going to wrap it up there. I'd like to thank all our speakers here today. Tomás McAnmara, Martin Manser, Padraig O'Rourke, and Joe Power. Now, our next Hedge School, which will be posted on the 31st of December 2021, will be Robert Barton, Forgotten Man of the Irish Revolution? And just to say that our first Hedge School of next year will be a live one, and Padraig O'Rourke will be on the panel for this one. This will be held in the Chapel Royal in Dublin Castle, and the topic is, quote, "Dublin Castle Has Fallen," unquote, the handover, 16th of January, 1922. So listeners, I hope you can tune in for either one or both of those, and I hope you enjoyed today's presentation. Thank you very much.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.